Time to look at the world of wildlife. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. If you have a question for Scott, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back. You just completed a couple of coverts workshops.
Yes, I've been up in, I've had the great pleasure of being up in northern Wisconsin for most of the last 3 weeks, and we did complete two of our four-day coverts, the Rough Grouse Society Private Woodland Owners Workshops at Kemp Station, and they were great. Great people, great weather for the first one, not so great for this second one. It was wretched up there last weekend, but holy mackerel, we really needed the rain in the North Country, and we got a pretty good rain. But I wanted to thank the listeners to the program here. Five or six of them actually, after we plugged the program back in early August, five or six actually came on as attendees, and they had a great time and thanked us for mentioning it on the program. And for the listeners who talked it up and recruited other attendees, that's also great. So we will we'll put an early plug in now that we'll be having two workshops, at least one, maybe two workshops, at Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk next August. And again, these are for private woodland owners who are interested in good forest stewardship, good land stewardship, and particularly with an emphasis on wildlife management. And boy, for 3 or 4 days, we have lots of interesting programs and demonstrations and field tours, and we eat well, and it's a great place. And it's
what
a good,
could be better?
What could be better? So, but it's nice to be back here. The weather's spectacular right now in southern Wisconsin. So.
As you look around your lawn, though, once in a while, a person's liable to see those mole tunnels. There's lots of mole activity right now.
The darn moles are driving me crazy. I came back, and my lawn was a little out of control, so I had to mow immediately, and there were mole hills and mole tunnels all over the place. But
now, have you tried that new system?
Well, I've had a couple of the listeners have been following up with me as they've tried that new trapping system we heard about back on the 1st of August. And the most recent one I heard from had good success and had caught some moles and was continuing to try it. And I intend to try it if I'm ever home long enough to give it a shot. But for folks who are curious, it was a listener called in and said, well, all you do is dig up these Now, moles are not easy to control, for one thing. So any news is good news. Anyway, dig up a little section of the runway so that you expose the hole, and then just sit a rat trap, a plain old snap-type rat trap baited with bacon.
Or bacon grease.
Or bacon grease right next to the opening. And then cover the whole shebang, the opening and the trap, with a big wash tub or bucket or something so that it's dark. And apparently the moles come along, and, oh, geez, what happened to the runway? But by the time they smell the bacon, they forget about the damaged runway and go right to the bacon and whack, end of the mole. Yeah. And the reason that's important is because some of the more traditional mole traps, like the harpoon type, really frighten the heck out of people, and as a result, they either won't use them at all or don't use them correctly, and then don't have success. But the good news is, what looks like a herd of moles must be out there digging is usually only the work of a handful of moles or two or three, because they do a lot of digging. So anything that will get you and the mole in close contact and ends up badly for the mole is a good thing. However, this time of year, I just don't worry about it very much because they're going to be headed deep soon.
Soon. Mark and Colfax, we're on to you now. Mark, hello.
Hello. I've had a badger move onto our property. We've got 7 acres, and so it's not too much of a problem. I would hope that he would get rid of some of my moles and pocket gophers and some of the rabbits, but my concern is I have some dogs, and the big ones I'm not worried about, but I got 2 terriers. One of them is a Yorkie rat terrier mix who she thinks she's 600 pounds and has the teeth of a saber-toothed tiger.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of worried about her well-being when we let her out at night.
Well, I mean, terriers are pretty feisty by nature, but so are badgers. Is the animal pretty close to your house?
Yeah, he's pretty close to the house, but of course, I mean, we don't see him because it's at night. And this dog is usually barking up a storm at any kind of rabbit or squirrel or anything, and she hasn't, you know, like gone down into any of the holes.
Well,
You know, I guess I understand your concern. A badger's a good-sized, powerful animal. They're kind of neat to see. They have quite a place in our tradition and heritage here in Wisconsin. But I understand your concern. I guess I can only say that in, 30-some years of doing this, I don't recall ever hearing a case of a dog-badger interaction that went badly on the dog's side. So I don't think there's a whole lot to worry about. But if you do have a problem where the dog and the badger come together, you can have the animal caught and removed. That's not the easiest thing in the world to do, but it can be done. And there are lots of folks around the state who belong to the Wisconsin Trappers Association who might be able to help you out in that regard. But I think if the animal is, more than 50 or 100 yards, the den's more than 100 yards away from the house, I'd be tempted to just try and keep a close eye on the dog when it goes out at night to do its thing and keep it under control. Really shouldn't have that much of a problem. Badger will keep its distance.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Sally in Wayland, Minnesota, we're on to you. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Scott.
Hey.
Hey. Sometimes the first Tuesday of the month is a long way off.
Uh-huh.
I've been waiting for this. I'm really glad you're back. I live in the Root River Valley. This place is so blessed, and what a gorgeous summer we had. Man, oh, man. Anyway, one side of the river, one side is the river, and the other side is forest in this Root River Valley. And a couple weeks ago, one of my neighbors on the ridge above me, probably less than a mile from here, spotted a bobcat. Mm-hmm. And I doubt that this guy was making up stories. I believe that there are bobcats out there, maybe more than one, and I'm happy. I'm happy they're there. But, of course, my concern is for my two baby goats, Honey and Cream. They're about 5 months old, and I'm sure to a bobcat they look like pretty easy pickings, and they are quite delicious. So do I need to be concerned about this?
How do you are they penned up? Are they what's the...
They're fenced in. The fence is just a heavy wire fencing with pretty heavy metal and wooden posts. They're well fenced, but I'm sure a bobcat could just leap over and just smack them.
Sure.
I just weighed them not too long ago, and they weigh like between 60 and 65 pounds apiece.
Well, that's about double the weight of the bobcat, so that would be a large prey item for the cat. And so help me out here. Wayland, Minnesota, kind of the southern part of the state?
Oh, man, you got to visit. It's so beautiful here. This is God's country. Yeah, we're about an hour from La Crosse.
In which direction?
East.
Oh, okay, so straight east of La Crosse, about an hour. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, so central.
Wait a minute.
We can't be east, or you'd be calling from Wisconsin.
Yeah, west.
Sorry, west.
Well, that's fine, and there's no question that in that kind of rugged country that comes off the Mississippi River and moves down into the Driftless area in Wisconsin, there have been more and more bobcat sightings, so... The issue is whether that bobcat's actually a resident or it's on the move. Because it could easily be on the move, and because they cover a lot of terrain, the likelihood that it's right there at any given time in the neighborhood of your goats is probably pretty slim. So in many cases like this, like the badger call, our response is usually going to be, hey, this is a pretty low-risk situation, but it's not a zero-risk situation. So it's kind of like the decisions we make every day to get in the car and head out into traffic or do all sorts of things like that we don't think much about. If those animals are pretty good size, but whether it's a coyote or a bobcat, and there's probably lots of coyotes in the area too that I'd be a little more concerned about, you do what you can to protect them and provide a secure pen or move them inside at night or whatever your options are. And one of the prices, in essence, you pay for living in that kind of a paradise
pristine place,
or pristine place, as you describe it, is that there's going to be wildlife there. And some of the wildlife has the capability, especially the larger species, to cause problems for pets or livestock. But that's part of the turf. So do what you can to keep them penned up and protected. Realize that the bobcats are probably not numerous there, and it may just be passing through. And go from there. There's no guarantee that it's not a risk, but I think it's a slim one.
All right. Thank you for calling, Sally. Appreciate your call. Sounds like you have a wonderful place. Gail in Whitehall, we'll turn to you next. And by the way, you can join in. We have some open lines, so you can get on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. And now let's turn to Gail. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I got a question. I have a deer cam picture of a gentleman took on some property here. It's either a very large bobcat or a small Canada lynx. Now, I know there's not supposed to be any lynx here, but there were two of them killed in the Whitehall area about 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Whitehall. What do the you have a pretty good picture of it? What do the ears look like?
Picture, it's a pretty good one. It's I've compared it. It's got the tufts on the ears. It got the the high
big feet
points. The feet probably a little hard to. It's a nighttime picture, obviously, and it shows up fairly good. But it's either a very large bobcat or a very small lynx. I know more than likely it should be a bobcat.
Yeah. Well, by odds, probably, but, this is from time gone by, and there are lynx at any given time, probably a few in Wisconsin, not very many, mm-hmm. and there may be years when there are none at all, but they were a bit more common in the northern forest in years gone by. So mm-hmm. it could be either one, but if you see those distinct ear tufts and it's a good-sized animal, then it certainly could be a lynx.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too, so... I'll just hang on to the picture. If I run into a game manager around here one of these days or something, I'll see what he thinks.
Yeah. See what they think, or make a photocopy of it and send it down to us, or send a digital image or whatever. We'd be happy to have a look at it, but I think it's certainly within the realm of possibility that's a lynx.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. That'd be a rare sighting.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan in Beloit, on to you now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. I got a lot of coyotes and raccoons coming up to my trash and eating out of them. I live out in the country. Last Saturday, my dog was out there, and a couple raccoons come up and started to attack my dog. Is there any poison or any way to get rid of them?
Well, Ryan, raccoons are so numerous that you can start in on a campaign of raccoon removal by, for example, just if they're coming to your trash, they'd be very vulnerable to a good-sized box trap, a live trap, wire live trap, baited with whatever delightful product is in the garbage or just with a can of sardines or fish-flavored cat food or a whole slew of other things. You can probably catch a bunch of them. Whether you can get the upper hand on the population or not is another matter. I've had lots of people over the years who have started removing raccoons and get to 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, whatever, and then say, holy mackerel, I've cut myself in here for a lifelong task. And that's really pretty much the case. They're so common that you might get a handle on them for a while, but there'll be more taking their place. So there's almost no guarantee that there is no guarantee that you could remove the raccoons from a given rural area and expect it to stay void of raccoons. So having said that, then trash management is going to be important in terms of, putting it out either when you're going to the dump or when they're coming to collect it or whatever. But otherwise, don't have it out there. And when it is out there, have it in metal cans, if you can, that are bungee corded so the animals can't get those lids off. And that'll slow them down as much as anything.
Yeah. All of the cans in our neighborhood are bungee corded because of that, raccoons. There you have it. Thanks for calling, Ryan. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go back to the telephone, take some more calls here. Melissa in Fitchburg, it's your turn. Hi, Melissa.
No, it's Lois in Fitchburg.
Oh, Lois. Okay.
Okay. Scott, I'm in the part of Fitchburg where you raised your kids when they were young, so you got an idea of the developed area.
I know it very well.
Okay. And we've been spotting a fox in our yard. The neighbors have spotted it, too. And in fact, my husband got a very good photograph of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very, to me, it doesn't look real healthy. It's mangy looking.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is my safety. I work in my yard, gardening, and also have grandchildren that visit here. So first of all, it's a safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
How concerned should I be?
Well, you know, not very, I think, unless you have some evidence that the animal is literally sick, injured in some way that might change its behavior for the worse as far as its interaction with people. We get lots of reports of foxes.
We have one mostly in our neighborhood.
Yeah, mostly reds, sometimes grays in more rural areas that have in some cases been kind of forced into the suburban environment by coyotes. Coyotes and fox don't get along very well. So they move in and find a good spot in an area like Fitchburg there in Wildwood or Wildwood South or Seminole Forest or whatever, where the lots are pretty good size and now they're mature, so there's lots of trees and parkland and so forth. Pretty good place for a fox, actually. Lots of rabbits, lots of squirrels, lots of ground squirrels and chipmunks. If my rock garden is still there at the house we sold, that animal could live off chipmunks for the rest of its life. But, you know, so it's not a bad place for fox. As long as people don't persecute the animals, they get along just fine in that environment and really shouldn't be a problem for anyone. And I think on average, most people where there's a fox in the neighborhood kind of become a little protective of it and take pictures of it and talk it up as, hey, we've got a fox, and it's kind of a neat thing. And until proven otherwise, that I think is probably the best approach. Now, if the city of Fitchburg gets a couple calls about it, or there's enough people agitated, or they get the neighborhood association concerned, then the animal would be relatively easy to remove and relocate. But at least for the time being, in the absence of any threats or aggressive behavior, I think it's just another neat curiosity and another neat component of urban wildlife to enjoy for while it's there.
We have.
Go ahead.
As far as the looks of it,
ours looks kind of mangy.
This time of year, they all look pretty ratty.
Okay.
But come winter, it should be a nice, sleek, long-haired fox, the way you think it should look.
Okay.
Okay,
great. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much for calling. Yeah, ours looks kind of mangy, too. And everybody in our neighborhood seen it. It's kind of fun to see. All right, Janet in Oak Creek. Your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
One morning I woke up, and I have a small retaining wall, and I found that some animal had removed the mulch, pulled back the landscape fabric, dug through about a foot to a foot and a half of dirt and stone to get to some bees or their honey. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if these are honeybees. They appear to be smaller than what I would usually consider to be a honeybee. And the next night, I woke up in the middle of the night and I discovered it was a skunk. So I was just wondering, I guess, wouldn't the bees sting the skunk, and what are the relationships that you hear of bees or bears and honey, but I've never heard of a skunk and honey, so just wondering what the relationship is and any information, and I'll listen off the air.
All right, thank you.
Well, just had another call about that this morning before I left the office, where skunks had dug up a ground nest of bees in an individual's garden and then moved away. Especially this time of year, a lot of the ground nests are yellow jackets that become active in late summer rather than honeybees, which tend not to be in the ground. I guess bumblebees will.
Yeah,
small nests in the ground, but not honeybees. But in any event, that's a good source of protein for the skunks in terms of digging up the nest, and not necessarily after honey, but after the brood combs and the larvae of the bees, hornets, or whatever it is they're digging up. And they seem to be relatively unbothered by the bees. They've got very thick fur, and whether they're doing what they're doing quickly enough or their fur is enough to protect them from the stinging, they don't seem overly troubled by that. At least they keep up the activity. So when you started out describing the situation, I was going to suggest that it was a skunk, since this is the time of year that happens a lot. It does happen, and if it's a yellow jacket nest the skunks have destroyed, then good for you, because you may be looking for some other way or reason to destroy the yellow jacket nest, as they're a bit of a picnic and backyard nuisance this time of year. So if you're not concerned about the skunk in the neighborhood, and the skunk seems to have gone on to do its business somewhere else, then no harm, no foul.
Yeah, and once the skunk is done with that nest, it's on to somewhere else, probably. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Chilton, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I'm trying to identify a nighttime sound. I'm sure it's a bird because it'll move from tree to tree. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's like a one-syllable sound. I can't really make it, but it's kind of like a... But it'll go from tree to tree, and I hear it every summer, and I don't hear it at all in the winter. Does that kind of ring a bell?
Your rendition does not ring a bell, but I understand how difficult it is to recreate sounds. But I'll just offer up a couple of alternatives. While there are a few night birds in the urban environment that make some sounds, you might hear a screech owl or other things like that. By far, the more common night sounds are created by several different types of frogs, which will move around a bit, or there are simply multiple animals in different trees. So it gives the appearance the animals running around when there are actually maybe just more of them. So things like a gray tree frog, but that has a very... The gray tree frog call is actually very musical and pretty, not harsh or single note. But there are a number of
like a hawk.
Yeah, there are a number of night calling insects that also will make, in some cases, a buzzing sound. In some cases, a single note. Tree crickets and a variety of other things will make night sounds. And I think the only way you're going to figure out for sure what you have is to either eventually get a recording that somebody can listen to, or go online if you're fiddling around with a computer somewhere and simply with Google call up night sounds, night insect sounds, whatever it takes to get to some recordings and see if you can actually hear something that sounds like what you're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more likely that it's insect or in some cases amphibian than it is bird.
Okay, there you have it. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Brad in Lake Geneva. Brad, hello.
Hello. Hello, Larry and Scott.
Hello.
Pleasure to talk to you fellas. I've got a frog pond, but it's located down south in Georgia near Lake Lanier.
Okay.
That is, it was a frog pond up until this year. I've been protecting it from predation from the local dogs and cats and mm-hmm. everything for years. But I think this year the birds and probably the blue herons or some of those big raptors that I see flying around
mm-hmm.
Have managed to take all my frogs. And so I'm wondering, where can I get some good old American bullfrogs to restock it? Because I rather enjoyed them.
Well, there are probably a couple possibilities. One is that you simply ask around and find who else has got a population and just get out there with grandkids or neighbors or Boy Scouts or whoever you can find to help and simply catch some and move them. The closer you can find a source population to your pond, the better, because moving these animals around the landscape at any length it can be problematic, that there are diseases, parasites, and other things that you don't want to move from one part of the state or country to another. So one option is the kind of the do-it-yourself project of finding either the adult frogs or someone who's got enough that you could go in with a net and seine up some tadpoles and put those back in your pond. The other option is mail order, and there are places that do sell bullfrogs and bullfrog tadpoles for just that purpose. In some cases, it may be biological supply houses that handle live animals, and in some cases, it's the kind of thing you find in the classified ads in the back of what I call the hook and bullet magazines like Outdoor Life, Sports Field, Field and Stream, and so forth. But I'm guessing if you got online and Googled source of bullfrogs mm-hmm. or source of bullfrog tadpoles, And I think Larry may be checking that for us now. I'm guessing you can find you can just order them through the mail.
Yeah, I've just there's all kinds of them.
So Larry says, there's all, what did you Google, Larry?
I just put bullfrogs for sale.
Bullfrogs for sale. There you go. Right. So they're all over the place.
And one quick follow up on the raccoons. Mm-hmm. In my yard here in Wisconsin, I recently observed no less than 6 raccoons that came out of the woods. I live in the middle of a woods.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out of the woods and were in the middle of the grassiest part of the lawn, and they stayed there. I'm not sure what they were doing for at least 45 minutes, moving around a little bit. The next morning, I went out there and found little divots, little mm-hmm. holes. Were they foraging?
They were digging up grubs. They dig up things like June bug larvae and other such things that are in the root zone of the turf, mm-hmm. and they'll just dig a little hole, maybe smaller than a golf ball, and dig out whatever they want and move on.
Was this likely a family?
It could have been.
Yeah.
Sure. This time of year, the young ones are pretty good size, probably a family group. And, be thankful they were just doing the little divots, because they're a strong enough animal that especially a newly laid turf, sometimes they'll just roll it right up and just, it looks like a bulldozer.
Oh boy.
And as long as we're on the subject, you didn't mention it, but how big is your frog pond?
It's about 150 feet.
Okay. All right. Well, I was going to suggest that there are ways on a smaller pond, either by stretching bird netting or monofilament fishing line, that you can discourage herons and other things that are interested in your frogs. But you can also help the frogs out a little bit by keeping as much cover as you can around the shoreline. And as long as you're willing to restock it, should
I was
be fine.
Considering putting a covering over just one corner of it where they could get underneath and hang out.
Well, you could do that and create a couple little sanctuary pockets on opposite corners or something like that, and at least then there's some frogs to restock on your own.
I absolutely adore to listen to them at dusk and at dawn. Mm-hmm. I even have some microphones strung out there so I can hear them in the house.
Okay. Well, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, we've got the fall hunting actually opened yesterday. Before we go back to the phones, somebody asked about that.
Yesterday was one of the first of the many opening days that will be coming up over the next 2 or 3 months. Doves and the early Canada goose season opened yesterday morning. The next big opener will be Saturday. It will be September 12th when the archery deer season and rough grouse hunting in the north, and a couple other things open up. And overall, of course, you remember the tremendous controversy over the dove season a few years ago, and now all of a sudden we're 4 or 5 years into the hunting, and it seems to have become a non-issue. So, but it was difficult to make that point back during the controversy. The fall forecasts are looking really good for the season again in terms of good herd of deer. Northern part of the state where you hunt, I know, has reverted back to what we remember as being a regular deer season in terms of the November hunt and fairly limited antlerless deer harvests because primarily the effects of the last two winters, which have really held the population down in the North Woods. There are a lot of other things going on. We can head in any direction you want on this. I think the new 10-year-old mentored hunting program it just went into effect yesterday morning as well. That has a fair bit of interest. There are some new chronic wasting disease rules in effect. Baiting and feeding ban on deer has been extended to add 2 more counties. That's up to 28 now. So, we're pushing the better part of half the state that now has a baiting and feeding ban. So that controversy continues of whether it should be a practice or not, but it's slowly eating away into the number of counties that are where the ban is, primarily for disease control.
Dan in Highland has a comment or question about white-tailed deer, I believe. Dan, hello.
Yes, I'm aware of a small herd of white deer, just a very small herd.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what you feel about them, if they should be in the whitetail herd. And then on top of it, I'm wondering if you know if it's the buck or the doe that spreads the gene that causes the deer to be white.
I think it's actually the genetic composition of either one. But the issue with white deer or albinos in Wisconsin has always been of interest to people because there's such a curiosity. And when you do see one in the woods, especially if it's kind of a gloomy, foggy day, it looks like a ghost. They are protected in Wisconsin, and therefore there are pockets of them around the state. Most of them, one of the areas where people go to see them is up around Boulder Junction, and there have been lots of things written about them. A beautiful pictorial book just produced a few years ago by Jeff Richter up in Boulder Junction about albino deer, and there's some fantastic photography of these animals, just beautiful. So there's plenty of information available. I think people, mostly landowners and the local folks, are fairly protective of them where they do occur, and the legal protection provides additional protection. If you're concerned that this albinism and the genetic conditions that cause it might become more prevalent and there'd be more albino deer and so forth, at least over the last 30 or 40 years, there doesn't seem to be any indication that it's progressing in the population enough to be anything more than the curiosity it is. And as human nature goes, unusual or aberrant animals are a curiosity, and therefore kind of neat to have them out there. No big deal biologically.
All right. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Mary and Spooner, we're on to you now. Let's see if I can find. Yeah, there you go. Mary, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just been curious about the apparent explosion of the coyotes up here in northern Wisconsin. I have never seen so many.
Spooner area.
Yep.
Well, why you're seeing them, I can't explain. And there may be some local, you know, a couple of pairs had particularly large litters, and they're doing well, and you happen to be seeing them in your area. I've not heard or seen in any of the DNR literature or survey information or whatnot that there's been any particular, you know, explosion, as you call it, over a broader area. So what goes on locally is often, you know, a lot of something in one area and not so much somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's why we get so many calls about, gee, there's not many birds at my feeders, or there's a lot of birds at my feeders, or I'm not hearing frogs and somebody else is hearing lots of frogs. So I can't explain what might be going on in your local area, but there certainly could be pockets with lots of coyotes. There are kind of hotbeds around the state, Waukesha County, the Mount Horeb area here in Dane County. Those are areas we hear about often as having what people perceive as lots of coyotes. And
yeah,
whether that's a matter of good habitat or some very productive pairs, I couldn't tell you.
Okay. There you have it, Mary. Thank you. Bill in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I live in a part of Madison where there's some prairie reclamation projects going on, and we have two indoor cats, and it's not unusual for us to get mice in there. One time, though, not too long ago, I saw something that didn't look quite like a mouse, and I got it out of little Charlie's mouth, and it turned out to be a bat. And the bat was uninjured by the encounter. I put him outside and he flew right away. The thing is, I haven't seen any bats before or since. And I was born and raised in the South where bats were the state bird practically in Louisiana.
Yeah.
And we liked having them because of how they kept the insect population down. You know,
sure.
They kept mosquitoes from just eating us alive. And I wonder how to attract bats.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'm pleased to hear that the cat was able to catch a bat, which is a reasonably fragile animal, and not cause any harm. So if it flew away, no harm. There are quite a few bats around. They're usually not down low enough where a cat would get a hold of one, so it would be unusual for the cats to catch them. There might have been a variety of explanations from where it came from.
Well,
but he's
good. I've seen him. He's caught as many as three mice in a single hour.
This is Charlie.
Yeah.
Charlie,
he's very
good.
Okay. Well, in any event, there are bat populations are doing pretty well. They're seven or eight species in the state, a couple of which are quite rare that you're not likely to encounter. But the short answer to your question is your best option in terms of attracting them is to either build or purchase a bat house and follow the instructions that come with it or that we have in our extension publication that talks about bat house building, and put that up in the right place. Higher is better than lower. Away from a north or northwest exposure is better. A building is better than a pole, and a pole is better than a tree. And there are some other guidelines. But the bottom line is get a good bat house, put it in the best place you have available, and be patient. And if bats occupy it, then you'll have them around for a good long time, assuming Charlie doesn't figure out how to get up the pole.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And there is a good extension publication, by the way, Bill. It's go to the Learning Store at the University of Wisconsin Extension Learning Store, and there's look around in there, and you'll find a copy of that publication. What's it called? Bats?
Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals.
Shelves, Houses, and Feeders for Birds and Mammals.
Yes, and otherwise, if you if you're near or get to a big bookstore or a nature center, the Bat House Builder's Handbook, which is published by Bat Conservation International, has many, many different plans in it. Stores like Wild Birds Unlimited and the other birding stores sell bat houses, as do some of the garden centers. So
sure.
It's a matter of buying one or making it a do-it-yourself project, or if you want to learn more about the North American Bat House Researchers Project and how to put them up and monitor them, go to batcon.org.
Batcon.org.
It's all right there.
All right there. All right. And we're right here with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a question about wildlife, I hope you do. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org as we visit with UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Scott Craven. And Roger in Lone Rock is up next, so let's go to Roger. Hi, Roger.
Hi. We have a 55-gallon metal barrel in the backyard, and we had some floating plants in a water hyacinth and water lettuce. And before we got to put fish in, some tree frogs, I'm guessing by the calls that were in the backyard that they were gray tree frogs, laid mm-hmm. eggs, and we had tadpoles hatch.
Cool.
And they've been emerging as frogs since August 4th, and I counted once a day and added those up and figured that's the best survey I can do, and over 500 have come out of there.
Wow, that's impressive.
I called your office or your UW biology and wildlife biology, and they said to give them cooked lettuce or cooked spinach. Well, we gave them broccoli leaves and kale leaves and Swiss chard leaves out of the garden and crunched them up so they started to break down, and they ate well. And then we had put some fish in there to eat the mosquito larvae, and one of those fish died, and by the time we found it, they'd eaten most of the flesh off of it, so we figured they were ready for protein. So we started giving them little bits of some cod we had in the freezer and fish flakes, and they've done well. My question is, we have probably, I bet you there's still another 100 or so in there. I gave some to the local elementary school that they're watching and will be releasing.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is, any of them emerging now probably are not going to make it through the winter.
Not necessarily. We could still have quite a few weeks of reasonable weather, and they're quite capable of sustaining and escaping problems in cool weather. So if they can get to, there's no reason to think that they're any worse off than all of their compatriots who are emerging from ponds and wetlands and so forth all around southern Wisconsin.
Okay. Another kind of follow-up. I've given some to an elementary, and I was thinking of contacting a couple more schools to see if they wanted to use them. Ones that don't emerge by October, would they stay as tadpoles over the winter, or they can turn into frogs, and then you could feed them bugs and release them in the spring? And my one question is, the ones that are really late, is there any concern about genetic defects that maybe you should just let them die and not try to help them?
Well, any genetic issue would have been expressed already, so that's not a problem. You've already hatched out and produced far more frogs from those one or two or three clutches of eggs from the adults that happened to get into your rain barrel than would have likely made it from any natural body of water. So you've done your part, Roger, for the frog population. So at this point, I guess I wouldn't be overly concerned. If you want to take what's left now and give them a little better chance, since your rain barrel may freeze up quicker than a natural wetland, and move them to a shallow, semi-permanent body of water and give them a chance there, I guess that would be the easiest thing for you to do.
Okay.
And simply purge your rain barrel and then be prepared for an influx of new frogs next year.
Will we have extra tree frogs in the backyard next year?
Well, I hope so.
Right.
And certainly that kind of emergence would give you a head start on that, but it really depends a lot more on the winter conditions than anything else. I've got quite a few gray tree frogs around my yard. I really enjoy them. I have three nice fat ones now that have taken up residence under the grill cover, so I can find them anytime I want to show them to the grandson or whatnot. And then they usually plaster themselves on the garage door at night and hunt bugs under the sodium light. So they're neat to have around, but previous to these past couple of winters when we had lots of snow, we had had relatively snow-free winters. And if it's fairly snow-free and cold so that there's deep frost penetration, then the frogs have a bit of a tough time. But if there's enough snow cover to keep them reasonably well insulated, you could have lots of frogs next spring.
All right, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Email here from I'm not sure who it's from, but it's an email about a person who this spring, while cutting hay, saw a bird he'd never seen before. It's the same size as a red-winged blackbird, but it had a gold spot on the back of its head and a bold white pattern on its wings and back. Didn't hear a song, can't go by that.
Sounds like a yellow-headed blackbird.
That's what it sounds like to me.
They do have some white on them, and they have a beautiful yellow head. So if they just got a quick look at it flying away, they may have only thought the gold was on the back of the head, but usually the whole head is yellow. So sounds like a yellow-headed blackbird.
And here's another one from Gabrielle. I've had major problems with chipmunks in the last three places I've lived. All have been somewhat close to parks. A recreation area. Several years ago, I theorized that maybe people were releasing them nearby. Well, about a month ago, my neighbor was in my yard chatting, and lo and behold, a big SUV pulled up within our sight and dumped a load of chipmunks essentially into our yards. Much to my frustration, my theory had been proven. On a previous show, it was mentioned that relocating them disorients them, and I have to say we noticed one that was the most nervous little chap I've ever seen. Can you please explain chipmunk habits and what your opinion on dealing with them is?
Well, first of all, chipmunks in suitable habitat, you know, rock walls and wood piles and parks and things like that, are incredibly abundant. Whether the population is being augmented by well-meaning neighbors or people from elsewhere in the community or not. But there are a couple of issues here. One is the issue of folks capturing things on their own property, in their own yard, and then under the theory that, well, it will live happily ever after somewhere else, they take it to the first green space they come to, the first farm on the edge of town, the first park or arboretum, and say, oh, this looks like a great home for chipmunks, rabbits, possums, whatever, and let it go. And that particular solution to the problem is fraught with difficulty. For one thing, you run into people like Gabrielle who don't want any more chipmunks, or the arboretum doesn't want any more raccoons, or etc. So this notion of solving suburban wildlife problems by simply catching the animal and putting it somewhere else not only may aggravate problems for someone else, but it may not be the perceived humane live happily ever after solution that people envision. Since the animals may be disoriented, they may be put into an environment where they don't know where shelter or potentially a home site is, or in the process of trying to find their way back, they're crossing who knows how many roads and they end up dead. The upshot of it is, while we sometimes talk about, oh, catch the thing and relocate it, the relocating part is a lot trickier than the catching part. And in many cases, it's ill-advised. under the circumstance where, hey, you've got a home in the city, but grandma and grandpa have got a big farm out in the countryside, and you know they don't seem to mind if you put a few extra chipmunks or raccoons out there, fine. But simply releasing the one or two that you or I release, or someone does, okay, that's one or two. But when you consider how many people in the suburbs are catching these animals, all of a sudden a likely repository, like the Arboretum or a park, is getting hundreds of these things. And their habitat is already saturated. So the relocation is problematic for a lot of reasons. Don't do it unless you absolutely have to or are forced to do so because there are no other alternatives. The chipmunks themselves, very common, small mammal, member of the ground squirrel family, pretty much disappear during the winter, store a lot of food, stay underground, good diggers, but around a bird feeder, in a garage, they can be a major pest. So people do tend to control them when they have a large number of them.
Terry in Land O'Lakes, on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi, thank you. We have a cabin about a half an hour north of Land O'Lakes, just over the border into the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And all spring and summer, we've had a pair of trumpeter swans in our marsh. There's a lake and a marsh by the cabin. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what they're doing this far south. I assume that they would be in Canada. And also, where are they going to go, and what can we do to encourage them to stay?
Well, first of all, they're actually – the south or north issue is not germane here because Wisconsin's been very actively attempting to restore trumpeter swans for quite a number of years now, and they've been pretty successful. So it's quite possible to see – what are we hearing there, Larry? Is that their radio? Anyway, it's quite possible to see trumpeter swans just about anywhere in the state at this point. So the fact that they're there must be up near Watersmeet. If they're banded, and many of them do carry neck bands, then that's something you would want to report to the local DNR office so that they can keep track of, they may be interested in where those particular birds are. If they're not banded, then you can't find out any information on their origin, but they likely were part of this long-standing restoration project. If they've found that marsh on their own and stayed for the summer, then they have found it suitable, and there's very little you can do to make it any more suitable for them. So keep your fingers crossed that they'll be back. They will leave soon and head further south for the winter and then potentially return to that spot again next summer.
Cool.
So they could originally have been brought in from where, part of the restoration project?
Well, it wasn't necessarily the original birds that were brought in for the restoration effort were brought in as eggs from Alaska and hatched at the Milwaukee County Zoo, and then there were various projects around the state to get them out in some of our larger wetland areas. But now, since that was successful, there are second, third, and fourth, and fifth generation birds that are being produced by not only the original releases of captive hatched birds, but birds that have been produced in the wild now. So, again, in the absence of a band, I can't tell you for sure where those particular two fit into the mix, but they're likely related to the original restoration effort with Alaskan eggs.
Hmm. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott, if you enjoy an occasional beer and you want to keep Pine Marten around, there is the Great Dane in Hilldale. Great Dane is a brewery restaurant, is now serving Pine Marten Red Ale. And they're donating 25 cents a pint to a Habitat Education Center. It's a Wisconsin nonprofit project devoted to protecting marten and other rare declining wildlife in the upper Midwest.
Sounds like a win-win situation to me.
Yeah, it does.
And Pine Marten Red Ale sounds pretty good. I think we should have lots of ales named after wildlife. But certainly that's a worthwhile goal. Martens have had a bit of a tough go of it over the years since the restoration efforts for those animals began at about the same time Fishers were brought back. But Fisher and Marten, both members of the Weasel family, kind of took different trajectories. The Fishers have grown by leaps and bounds and are all over the place in the north and now to some extent in the south, whereas the martens have kind of hunkered down and barely hung on in a couple of the release areas. So there are lots of folks working on this particular problem and trying to isolate what actually they could do to release the martin population a little bit more. But any effort that helps with habitat restoration is a good deal. And, hey, if the donations come from beer or any other product, great.
That's great. Bill in Madison emailed us, and this has to do with the night bird sounds. He notes there's one bird that makes a raucous sound at night. It's the young great horned owl. They hang out on a tree limb, and every 15 seconds or so, they'll let out a shriek. Usually they're looking, waiting for their parents to bring food to them, and they'll change locations. Maybe move from limb to limb on a different tree. And at some point during the year, this stops, and as you know, the youngsters hopefully have learned to hunt for themselves. But the sounds can be pretty loud.
They can. A barred owl's the same thing, and young barred owls do a lot of begging too. But the owl sounds are very they can almost be terrifying. You think someone's being tortured in the woods because the vocalizations are loud and are rather varied and more shriek-like, scream-like, hooting, howling, and so forth, rather than the kind of the single call note that that was mentioned. But, hey, there are lots of possibilities.
Yeah, there sure are. Bill said in his note that when he was walking under a tree when one let out a shriek, and he got some goosebumps. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Net. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my old friend Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Have a question about some wildlife in your area or maybe somewhere else? I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Stephen in Madison, who's been waiting a while. Stephen, hi.
Hi, it's been a pleasure waiting. It's been a really fascinating and fun hour. So, My question is about the relative safety of my puppy. He's a little 8-pound guy. We've had the nice fortune of staying with my folks this week in there. They've got a really nice fenced-in backyard on Madison's west side. And they live close to the Owen Park Conservation Center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I had the increased good fortune to have my path crossed the other night by a coyote on our little suburban street. He was very brave and walked right past me, and I remembered reports of increased coyote activity in the area. And I, try and supervise the dog as much as possible outside, but he's a little guy, and they've got bushes, and they let him out sometimes to wander in the backyard. It is fenced in, but I'm wondering if I should be more concerned about his safety out there if he is ever alone.
Well, Stephen, I guess I would refer you to the local city council member out there in the area to see what the upshot was of a community forum that was held about 6 months ago on the west side. I participated in terms of talking about coyote ecology and so forth. There were many other people who made presentations. But the impetus for that public forum held at Memorial, Madison Memorial, was, or at the Lussier Center there at Madison Memorial, was concern raised by residents around the park and the conservancy and generally the west side there in a general sense, that there had been some dog attacks and the coyotes were very bold and people were concerned. And what surprised me a little bit, there were well over 100 people in there for the forum. And toward the end, we took a little poll. How many folks here in the audience have had a dog attacked, or there were some deaths apparently? And there were 8 or 9 people who stepped forward and said, yes, we've had a problem, which I thought was a fairly high
number.
Frequency.
Yeah.
And so their concern was certainly warranted. What, if anything, has been done as a result of that forum? I don't know. I've not heard of any particular actions taken, coyotes removed, or anything like that. But since there were so many people who had issues, and there have been records of coyotes jumping a fence and taking small dogs, I guess if I were in that neighborhood, my dogs are 85-pound labs, so my concern is a little less. Even though I know I've got coyotes who move through my property in the town of Oregon, I generally, if I hear the animals, I make sure the dogs are in, or if I'm with them, if I'm walking them before we go to bed. But for a smaller dog, particularly in that area where there's been a bit of recent history of problems, I would do everything I could to keep a close eye on it.
Yeah.
You know, certainly walking it on a leash or being with it reduces any particular risk, and you certainly have some options if a particularly bold coyote were to approach. But a small dog out in the backyard in the evening roaming around, again, although I think, as we've talked about several times here over the past hour, the risk is low. It's not zero. It's still there, and that's in an area where there have been known problems. So yeah. I would be cautious.
And I think that the especially having the note of caution in the evening is particularly acute and apt. Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, we had a couple of emails, one from Steve in Madison, one from Barbara in Richland County, over the caller who called in about the bird with a kind of a gold patch on its head.
Oh, bobolink.
Bobolink.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. It just occurred to me that the white with a patch on the head rather than the entire yellow head, it probably was a bobolink.
Yeah.
Good. Thanks. Our listeners are paying more careful attention than we are.
Let's go to, all right, so bobolink it probably was. Dave in Sheboygan, on to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Fun, great show today, guys. I wanted to ask a kind of a silly question. My kids and I were sitting around the campfire this weekend, and my older kids were scaring my younger son with stories about a water creature, or Sheboygan werewolf, that comes up from the lake, evidently near North Point, and then one of my other kids was talking about a story about that he'd heard about Black River south of town where there's some sort of a swamp monster. Anyway, they were very entertaining stories, and I wondered if Scott comes across stories like this, sort of the cryptozoology sort, and if he has any fun stories to tell.
Well, you know, when people let their imagination run wild, you can come up with almost anything. But there are certainly legendary creatures around the state, like the Hodag up in Rhinelander and other such things that attain folklore status. And you know, people have their little stuffed Hodags in Rhinelander. And
yep.
There may be other such things in other part of the state as well. But sometimes I think fact is stranger than fiction. And I've always been one of the things when we're talking about natural history of various animals, and you talk about the capability of some of these things and some of the weird-looking things like star-nosed moles, for example,
yeah.
Or the appearance of some tadpoles and big salamanders like mud puppies that people occasionally catch on a fishing line. There's enough true stuff out there that's pretty weird or pretty slimy or pretty ugly or something that you don't have to let your imagination create things. But certainly a good campfire story built around unusually, you know, large or ferocious beasts make for good entertainment. But there's nothing that I know of in Wisconsin that warrants that kind of concern right now.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks for the answer.
Sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. Henry in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Henry.
Hello. I just wanted to comment about the relocating wildlife discussion and remind people that you really are supposed to get permission from a landowner when you release an animal onto their property.
Including public land.
Including public land.
Right.
So, you know, not only may that pest now pester the new landowner where you released it, but legally, if you find people unloading animals that you don't desire to have on your property, you can, you know, see about pressing charges if it becomes a real big problem.
Yes, that's a good point, Henry. It's a good point, and it's important to note that that's true people might buy into that or think about it in terms of letting something go in someone else's backyard or a farmyard, but it's also, and therefore think that, oh, a DNR wildlife area, well, that's open territory, but it's not.
It's not.
If it's parkland or DNR property or other state land, you're obligated there to find the property manager, be it the wildlife manager, park supervisor, or whatever, and attempt to obtain permission. But I think you're probably more likely to get permission from a benevolent, wildlife-loving rural property owner than you are from the public land managers who recognize the potential problems.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, and the big thing is, of course, that if the animal was doing damage on your property, then perhaps the other property owner doesn't want it doing damage on their property.
Yeah,
that's right, and a raccoon that's tuned into living in a chimney flue as opposed to a hollow tree, once it is relocated, is more likely to seek out another chimney flue than a hollow tree and therefore become a problem for someone else.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Henry. Appreciate it. Bonnie in Gutenberg, Iowa, your turn. Hi.
Good afternoon. I watch a fairly large animal crawling around a tree, eating the leaves. What is this?
What does it look like?
Well, it's...
Does it look like a big fat squirrel?
Well, it's much larger than a squirrel.
Yeah, but it looks kind of short-legged and fat and rotund.
Yeah,
it's
short-legged and fat.
Okay, then that's a woodchuck.
A woodchuck. Now,
yes, most people don't realize that woodchucks or groundhogs are good climbers, but they're very good climbers. And when you see one for the first time in a tree, it just looks like, whoa, that animal shouldn't even be there.
Well, that's what I was thinking as it's waving around on the branches.
Yeah,
so it's a woodchuck.
It's most likely a woodchuck.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. On to Jake in Wittenberg. Jake, hello to you.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
General question about snapping turtles. Everything is cyclical, of course, with wildlife and pretty much the world. Do you have any indication of the population as far as, I don't know, say the whole state of Wisconsin, maybe Minnesota?
No, not really, and snapping turtles along with painted turtles, because they're so common and so widely distributed, generally folks don't pay as much, from a management standpoint, aren't paying as much attention to them as they might be Blanding's turtles or wood turtles or box turtles that require a little management intervention. But all I can say is from my experience, my limited experience driving around this spring, particularly in the northern part of the state, and from the number of people who reported moving a snapping turtle across the road or whatnot, it seemed like there were a heck of a lot of them out there.
Okay, I have done that before, and I'm careful to wear my gloves.
Yeah, you have to be pretty careful the way you handle them. They're surprisingly quick, and their jaws are surprisingly powerful. But nevertheless, I guess from those anecdotal reports, it seems like the population's doing pretty well.
Okay, and one final question. Are box turtles less common than wood turtles in the state?
Box turtles, the ornate box turtle, is an endangered species and very much restricted only to the southwestern corner of the state in dry, sandy areas along the Wisconsin River and into some of the southern counties. So there's an animal with populations that probably total in the hundreds, maybe, whereas wood turtles are more widely distributed. Still rather rare and threatened, I believe, but not an endangered species.
And box turtles are more common in the Northeast, like New England area?
There are different types of box turtles around the country, but the further south and west you go, the more box turtles you'd find.
Okay.
And there are some to the east as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Got an email from Kelly Kearns at the DNR, and she says, someone told me you had a caller who wants to release tree frogs and water hyacinth. Well, I don't think it was water.
Oh, no. That water hyacinth is not a native species. That would be, I think, if I remember the call, it was Roger from Lone Rock, and he had the 55-gallon rain barrel full of tree frogs. They may have picked up a water hyacinth at a garden center for decorative purposes in the barrel, but you certainly wouldn't want to put a water hyacinth in a native water body.
There is also a state law that makes it illegal to release wildlife any place away from where they were originally taken. So she said, apparently you're not supposed to release tree frogs either away from the area where they were originally.
Well, True, but I guess I wonder what that means. Is the area they originally taken, is that the rain barrel, or is that their backyard, or is it their is it the range the tree frog might have come from its overwinter? Yeah. I'm not so sure about that part of it, Larry, but certainly from Kelly's perspective in terms of invasive plants, that would be a huge mistake, but the frog's a little less problematic.
Yeah, the water hyacinth, unlikely it's that it would survive our winter, but you never know, and you don't want to...
Stranger things have happened.
Yeah, yeah. And then regarding the Charlie, the cat that we talked about earlier, who had the bat down, Mary in Oshkosh emailed to say, I had a cat who would perch himself on the rail of a second floor landing and bat bats out of the air, then bring them to me. One night he brought at least five in the course of an hour before I locked him indoors to avoid having to retrieve bats and discard them before he ate them. So,
well, you know,
cats are pretty...
cats are very efficient predators, and this brings up the whole issue again. While it's easy to make it sound humorous that the cat was pretty good about grabbing them out of thin air or perching on the railing or whatever, it does... It is an example of the larger problem of cats outdoors, and I meant to thank you for sending the that information on the Bird Conservancy's Cats Indoors program. Yeah. The fact still remains that although it's very controversial, well-meaning cats, well-fed cats, pet cats, wonderful friendly cats will in fact, as Mary's cat on the second floor landing, kill significant numbers of native wildlife, and bats are native wildlife. They have a variety of ecological functions, and cat predation is a significant source of mortality for lots of small mammals and birds, and it's the reason why I just would rather see cats inside, period.
Hans in Sturgeon Bay wonders of that yellow jacket nest. With the skunk digging up the yellow jacket nest, he wonders if there's any other animal that typically would do that, like a groundhog, for example.
Well, the issue here is that a groundhog is a rodent, and most of our burrowing mammals, the chipmunks and ground squirrels and groundhogs and so forth, are rodents and would have relatively little interest in the either the brood or the honey or anything else a food source. Whereas skunks, the notorious predators on bees and beehives are skunks and bears.
Let's go to Bob in Sun Prairie now. Hello, Bob.
Hi. I was wondering if you could give me the department where I could get a listing of some type or maps of public fishing and hunting grounds. There's so many departments. I was just wondering if you could pinpoint something for me.
Well, if you go to the, do you use a computer?
Yeah, I do have.
Well, you can either go on to the general DNR website, which is DNR.wisc.gov.
DNR.wisc.gov.
Yes, I think that's it. But find the DNR website, and you can Google that, just Wisconsin DNR, and then you can click on there's a menu that will come up, and you can click on hunting or fishing, and there are a whole series of things from which you can choose, and they have very nice pre-printed maps of the state which list all of the public hunting grounds and what species are present and how to get to them and where the parking is and all that kind of stuff. And I think the same thing is true of the Bureau of Fisheries in terms of state fisheries areas. But the issue there is that because of our public waters, essentially any body of water, be it river or many of the thousands of lakes, are all essentially potential fishing areas. So in that case, it may be a little more difficult to pin the information down. But you can also stop at any DNR service center, and that pre-printed, fairly large fold-out map, at least of the wildlife management areas, is readily...
Nice map
and readily available at any of the service centers.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I never thought of the computer. Good idea.
All right.
And then I just had a second part quick.
Sure.
How do you tell the difference between a groundhog and a woodchuck? I mean, they almost look alike, don't they?
Well, they are the same animal.
Same thing.
It's the same thing. It's just two different names for the same animal.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Falcon in Hollandale, we're on to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I live quite a ways out in the country, and for this most of this summer, on maybe twice, a couple times a month, I have heard an individual animal howling that sounds quite distinct from the coyotes that I hear quite a bit, and I'm wondering if there's any wolf activity out here in southwestern Wisconsin, because when this particular individual begins to howl, all the coyotes go suddenly absolutely quiet.
And it's because they don't want to become dinner. Well, the short answer to your question is sure. The stronghold for wolves is still the northern part of the state and some areas in the central part of the state. But there was a wolf, I think it was last winter, where there were some really good photographs of a wolf down in Lafayette County and some wolf activity out around Yellowstone Lake, which isn't too far from you. And the animals are highly mobile, so sometimes they pass through the area even though they don't take up even temporary residency. So although it would be unusual and still quite a curiosity, it's certainly within the realm of possibility that there was or is a wolf in your area.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Gene and Ashland, on to you. Hi, Gene.
Hi, something serious. I know that anthrax is found in the wild, and I was wondering, where would you find it? What the possible vectors for it?
I just can't tell you a whole lot about that, Gene. I think if you're curious about that, I would go to the Wisconsin Department of Health and Social Service (DHSS) website, and they have listings and fact sheets on all sorts of disease problems like this, and you'll get the facts you need. But for me to speculate or give you, you really need the facts on something like that.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you. Neil in Heartland, we're on to you. Neil, hello.
Hi. My question is, we got a place up north in Forest County on Roberts Lake, and we've owned it for about 6 years. And within the last year, we've had something gnawing. It gnawed once on the patio stoop, which we made out of wood. And then trying to get into the garage on the wood around the doorways.
Mm-hmm.
It's the gnawing is only goes up maybe 6-7 inches high, and it's pretty narrow furrows of gnawing marks.
Mm-hmm.
We're wondering what that is. My brother-in-law thinks it might be a possum, but we don't have any visual sightings of it.
Well, it's not a possum. A possum won't gnaw like that. They don't have the teeth to do that. If you're seeing these little paired grooves in the wood, then that means it's a rodent. Of some kind, a possum is a marsupial, so not a possum. But what rodent it is, you mentioned that the tooth marks are fairly small, which suggests potentially, and they're low to the ground, which suggests squirrel or chipmunk or something like that. And they'll routinely chew around the base of a garage door or chew the rubber gasket off in order to get in. So that's one possibility. But, of course, the notorious cabin chewer-upper in the North Woods is a porcupine.
Yeah.
So if the if the grooves are an eighth of an inch or so, I'd still suspect a more likely a porcupine. But it could be some of those other small rodents as well.
Okay. And we have like recycled cans in there, so we're wondering if maybe he's trying to get at the sweet smell of the leftover sodas.
They may smell something in there, or in some cases, in the case of the chipmunks and squirrels, they're just looking to get in and use it as potential shelter.
All right.
All right.
Excellent. Thanks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, we'll be winding up here in a minute, but the birds are kind of winding up. Many birds are winding up their stay in Wisconsin and flocking up and getting ready to head out.
They are getting ready to head out. The swallows and some of the insect eaters are often the first to flock up. But holy cow, I looked out the window at sunrise Tuesday morning, and the yard was just alive with robins. There must have been a flock of 200 in the yard. I had finally had a few berries on my mountain ash tree, which I was enjoying looking, those pretty orange berries. Boom,
gone
like that. So the robins are starting to flock up, the swallows, the other insect-eating birds, and it will be a steady progression of birds out and through for the next couple of months.
Well, I tell you what, it's been a great pleasure. Again, thank you so much, and you'll be back the first Wednesday in October.
Correct.
We'll look forward to that. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's the way it all pretty much always works. Just to look ahead to tomorrow's program, Home renovation and repair is the topic that we're going to be dealing with tomorrow. What's going on with your home? If you got some repair issues or some renovation issues, Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin will be our guests. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.